This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our broadcast and online Main Street across North Dakota this time of day. Today we'll begin our show talking about work for the disabled, and we'll talk about it with Damian Schlinger. He's the director of the Vocational Rehabilitation Division for the North Dakota Department of Human Services. Damian, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Doug, for inviting us on to talk about employment of people with disabilities. I appreciate it.
And Megan Stone is a vocational rehabilitation counselor. She works one-on-one with disabled workers. And Megan, thank you for spending time with us today.
Yes, happy to be here.
Damian, we're going to start with the basic question here. What is North Dakota's definition for a disabled worker?
Sure. So people with disabilities are anybody out there that wants to share their talents, achieve their employment goals, and actively participate in the workforce in their communities. And it can be from a variety of different types of disabilities, and there's really four main ones that we work with. So you're probably familiar with physical disabilities. These are the ones that are easier to see. It could be people that are have mobility challenge. Perhaps they use a wheelchair. Another one is intellectual. So it could be autism, folks with Down syndrome. I know that I have a couple cousins. This was my first exposure to people with disabilities was through the cousins that I have. Third is cognitive. So people with learning disabilities fall into that category. And then the last is behavioral. So these are people with anxiety, depression symptoms, and so on. So it can be anybody within that realm would be people that we would help in vocational rehab.
Damian, we're not just talking about, assembly line workers here, are we?
No, certainly not. So I think that's probably one of the misconceptions is that, people with disabilities are only in a general labor role, and that couldn't be further from the truth. When we look at, our information, and I actually have it in front of me here, 11% are in professional positions, 21% in administrative support, 3% in executive or management positions, and we had one individual actually go on to be a physician. So it's all kinds of occupations out there that these folks can fill that role.
And how many people in North Dakota would qualify as disabled workers?
So there are 41,000 working age North Dakotans that have one of those types of disabilities that I just mentioned. So it's a lot. It's a lot more than I actually had thought of before I came into vocational rehab here.
Megan, what attracted you to this kind of work?
I think work is an important part of life, and my background is in mental health field, and I just thought that this was a really interesting way to help individuals in need and engage with the community.
Well, Damian, one of the reasons we wanted to talk to you and Megan was that we're in the midst of a pandemic, and we've been talking with lots of sectors of the North Dakota economy about people who have been displaced, maybe lost their jobs or are working from home like I am right now. How has the pandemic affected this segment of employment, the work of disabled people?
Sure. In a lot of ways, it's affected them very similarly to, folks without disabilities, and it's been in those industries where technology-related jobs, folks that are more in administrative roles, things of that nature, people that have been able to do their jobs remotely or via computer, those are the folks that haven't had their employment interrupted quite as much. But in the other areas where we have some folks with disabilities that are in the service sectors, areas like that, those types of industries, theirs have been disrupted fairly similarly to those of the general population.
Megan, what have you seen in terms of the people you're working with?
Similar to what Damian just said, we've seen individuals face additional barriers similar to individuals without disabilities. Maybe they lost the position because the employer closed, or they're facing maybe some more health, physical or mental health concerns due to the pandemic, and having to make tough decisions about whether or not to go to work.
Damian, what are the most significant federal and state laws and regulations that apply to disabled workers?
Oh, that's a big question, Doug. So we are under the Rehabilitation Act of 1973. So everything that we do really flows from that act. And then there was also another one called WIOA that was recently passed in 2014 that we operate under. So, and then there are also all kinds of different state or local I guess you could say, regulations that we also work with, which could be anything from tax credits to housing. There are a lot of different things that factor in, and probably Megan could speak to some of those, how it integrates on the client level a little bit more closely.
Megan?
Yeah, so kind of just depending on an individual's eligibility for different state and local, what are called waivered services, can open up an individual to various services in their communities, like Damien said, housing, mental health treatment, and then vocational services like ourselves.
Just to clarify here, Megan, who do you represent, the employer or the worker or both? How does this work?
We actually support both sides. We like to consider ourselves kind of a part of an individual's vocational team, but also a resource to employers as well. We work to, again, support both sides, looking for long-term employment fit, which is a benefit to both the employer and the individual.
Damien, you talked about the federal and state laws and regulations that apply to this area of employment. Are there incentives for employers to hire disabled workers?
Absolutely, there are. So I touched on that just a little bit ago in our previous question, but we do have some information on our site as well as some of those. And actually, now that legislative session is going through, there are a couple different new proposals where employers can take advantage of some tax credits and so on in that area. So I invite people to, give us a call and learn more about those.
Well, you mentioned that there are 41,000 people in North Dakota who might qualify as potentially disabled workers. How receptive are employers to hiring people?
There are some employers who are more open than others to just having conversations and learning. I think that there's just kind of bridge into educating employers is, again, who individuals who are open to having that conversation and learning about vocational services. Again, as I mentioned before, we're part of a team, and so we're not there to replace any services an employer has or replace training. We're just there to best kind of like highlight the aspects of their training that are going to support an individual long term.
Damien, anything to add to that?
I think one thing that I've learned about in vocational rehab is I'm actually really proud of the business community and how they've embraced people with disabilities. So I don't know if people know this either, but 57% of people in North Dakota with disabilities are employed. So it's a lot. It's the majority, actually. And actually, nationwide, North Dakota is number one in that perspective. And they also have the smallest gap in North Dakota between the general workforce employment rate and the people with disabilities employment rate. So I think they've got a long-standing tradition, and employers, I think, to Megan's answer earlier, I think sometimes you just need to open their eyes to what's possible. So if people do need an accommodation, usually it's pretty simple and pretty easy. I used to work in the medical world, too, at an occupational medicine clinic. And I think on occasion there can be, because it's not something maybe they deal with constantly, but we have experts inside vocational rehab that can speak to ADA and how to do it and how to do it right. And then it ends up benefiting your other employers or your other employees, too. I think about in my old role where I used to be in the medical arena, sometimes we would get something very simple, which was like a Tommy gate, which is an end gate that helps lift heavier objects up into the gate of a pickup. Well, that not only benefits the person with disability, but it benefits everybody else from preventing a back injury as well. So I think those are things that are integrated into the business environment very easily.
Damien Schlinger is director of the Vocational Rehabilitation Division for the state's Department of Human Services. Megan Stone is a vocational rehabilitation counselor. She works in the Fargo area. Megan, do employers find you or do you find them?
It's a little bit of both. So there are, some businesses within the Fargo community and across the state of North Dakota that we have built relationships with across over the years. But our services are individualized. So, sometimes our business networking comes from interests of a consumer. So that means us as counselors, we go out into the community and work to engage with employers that have openings of the individual's interests.
Megan, how does the productivity and reliability of your disabled clients compare with workers who aren't disabled?
Similar to how we were talking earlier about some of the barriers that individuals without disabilities face. You know, we look to put abilities first, you know, and so the productivity and work tolerance, it may need a form of accommodation so that they're able to meet the demands of this position, similar to somebody without a disability. And so we, you know, look again to say, like, maybe they may not be able to, say, be on their feet for 8 hours a day, but, like, what are some ways that we could maybe find some tasks where they're able to sit down and, again, still meet the demands of that full-time position, but with some form of reasonable accommodation so they're still able to meet the demands of the job.
And are some of these jobs the kinds of jobs that employers might find it difficult to fill, that people with disabilities might be uniquely suited to fill?
Yeah, I think that in North Dakota, you know, even pre-pandemic, we've had a great economy and a lot of job openings. So I think that, you know, we work to help employers fill positions that they may be just struggling to fill. And, you know, the nice thing about working with vocational rehabilitation is that, you know, we can help the business support the individual and be help them find that loyal employee and dedicated employee, you know, and that employee just may need maybe a little extra time to learn the job. But again, they're going to be the one that stays around and is committed to showing up every day and every shift.
Damian, let's talk about the paper trail here. Is there oversight by your agency that's required after someone is placed in a job? What sorts of requirements are placed on you in this relationship?
Well, actually, I was going to say, Doug, if I could just go back to that previous question with Megan. I thought she did a good job, but I just wanted to add something to it when you were talking about, you know, the type of folks that will go into those. And I think Megan did a great job earlier talking about our aim is really dual. It's between the individual and the business. So when they're coming into us, we're looking at those skills and abilities. And then also, what are their vocational goals? Like, what do they find interesting and fulfilling and so on? So I think when you talk about getting somebody that's skilled and able and dedicated, that match works out really well because we help them with the skills, if there are any, that are between their abilities and that vocational goal. So they tend to do really well in that employment. So sorry to take a little detour there, but I just thought I'd add to that a little bit.
Not at all. Is oversight by your agency required, though, after someone is placed in a job?
For sure. So our federal partners and our grants, and then also on the state level, we have requirements to fill out at this federal level. It's Rehab Services Administration. So we have reporting that we do with collecting information on all kinds of things, whether it's the number of folks that are enrolled, how many are placed. And then there's also some subcategories of programs when we talk about customized employment, supported employment. And then also we do a lot of work in the schools throughout North Dakota, 62 of them, which includes all the high schools, in working with those people with disabilities even before they go out into the job force, so that we can help them early on, so that it's not more difficult that they get into the workforce and then struggle or have challenges and then need it. We try to get ahead of the program a little bit.
Megan, what kinds of support might you provide to a disabled person looking for a job or who has a job but has a challenge getting to the job or some other issue?
Again, as I've previously mentioned, our services are individualized because the types of barriers that they come to us with, again, vary case by case depending on their disability. So supports can range from connecting them with training, as Damian has mentioned, and training can look different. It's not always that, post-secondary or apprenticeship type options, but also training opportunities where we utilize employer and community resources to help with on and off-site job coaching. Other services, come alongside through, vocational counseling and guidance. We help them. Sometimes individuals come to us either at a young age, as Damian mentioned, helping with career exploration paths that way. And sometimes individuals are coming to us looking to restart their second career of life. So we do a lot of career interest exploration and guidance and support to help them be a competitive candidate for the openings in their community. Other barriers that we help individuals overcome, too, are sometimes there are transportation barriers or even things that we call like work maintenance items or accommodations. So things sometimes, you know, an individual can get a job, but they don't have the resources to get the tools and supplies needed to start that job. So we look to be able to financially assist with some of those resources or with physical accommodations at work. Maybe they need like a sit-stand desk or something that's going to make it so that they can have the tolerance to make it through the whole day.
You know, workplaces have their own life, if you will. There's a social environment. Of course, there's the job as well. How about a disabled employee and an employer who aren't getting along? How do you work with employers who've encountered challenges with disabled workers?
I think that's a challenge that an employer could face with an individual with or without a disability. And, you know, some of the things that we offer are just advocacy. Oftentimes we can be an advocate for an employee. And we also, though, again, serve employers. So, again, we work to kind of just be that third-party mediator to make sure that, you know, the best resolution comes for, again, both parties, whether that may mean looking at a different job position or duty within the same company, maybe under a different direct supervisor, and just making sure that the whatever maybe conflict or argument that both sides are feeling, both sides are then heard, and again, working to find a resolution that works for both parties.
What kind of a caseload do you have, Megan? How many people are you working with?
I serve about, let's say, 70 individuals, and I would say about 25% of them are students, so between the ages of like 16 and 20, and then the rest are adults, so anywhere between the ages of 18 to however old you'd like to work.
Damien, do you have enough Megans?
Yes, we do. I was going to say we have a lot of staff, which is wonderful, throughout the state. We have 8 regional offices, so Grand Forks, Fargo, Devil's Lake, Jamestown, Bismarck, Minot, Dickinson, who am I missing? Williston, as I moved from east to west there. So, yeah, so we have vocational rehab counselors. We have vision rehab specialists as well that help people with vision impairments as well. So we're lucky to have folks like Megan out in the field.
And what are you looking for when you hire somebody to be a counselor like Megan?
Well, they have to have a couple things as a counselor. So they do have to have a master's degree, and then they also have to have a CRC, which is a credential in rehabilitation as well. That's something that they can work toward once they're employed, but there is that minimum bar as they go in. So these are people that are highly educated and trained, and they do a great job in the field. It's been a pleasure to work with them.
How about self-employed disabled people? Do you interact with them?
I can touch on that a little bit. We actually have a program, I'll just shine a light on one specifically, called Randolph Shepherd, which involves people that are in the food industry, so they can be self-employed in that program, and we work with them, and they run whatever, restaurants, cafeterias, micro markets, whatever it may be. So that's one program where we work with self-employed folks. I don't know if Megan can shine a light on any other situations that she might be aware of.
Yeah, so self-employment is one of the services that we do are able to put on an individual's plan for employment through vocational rehabilitation. And so a lot of that is more so resource navigating with an individual as they're looking to start up self-employment or maybe looking to expand or grow a business that they already are operating. So, you know, we look again just to evaluate their business plan and see if there are vocational resources and supports that would help them with their mission of, again, growing and or starting a business.
Megan Stone is a vocational rehabilitation counselor for the North Dakota Department of Human Services. Megan, thanks for spending time with us today.
Thank you.
And Damien Schlinger is in charge. He's the director of the Vocational Rehabilitation Division for Human Services. Damien, thank you for spending time with us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Next on Main Street, learning about the Constitution.
Hey, this is Steve Inskeep with Morning Edition from NPR News. A morning routine only works if all the pieces come together. You won't have your morning coffee if the machine doesn't work. You won't be brushing your teeth if the toothpaste tube is empty. Well, Morning Edition from NPR News never runs out or breaks down. You rely on us for information you need to get up and get going. Listen to Morning Edition every weekday.
Morning Edition weekdays beginning at 4 a.m. Central, 3 Mountain on Prairie Public.
What do these people think of me? It's a question that can act like an anchor, dragging us down and keeping us from succeeding.
They might tolerate you out of a sense of, well, you know, we should, but could they really believe in you?
How other people's stereotypes about us get inside our heads. This week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
That's tonight at 8 Central here on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Could you pass the U.S. citizenship test? You might be surprised. Regardless, there's a new class from Humanities North Dakota that could boost your civics knowledge. Under Adult Civic Education, Constitution 101 runs Wednesdays for 6 weeks starting February 24th. Chris Cavanaugh is an advanced placement U.S. history teacher at Bismarck High School, and he visited with Ashley Thornburg.
Thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Who is your intended audience for this 6 week class?
I think the intended audience is really anybody that's interested in the founding era, how the Constitution came to be, and how it's been used throughout our nation's history to justify some of our actions. So I think it's anybody that wants to make themselves an engaged or enlightened citizen.
So walk us through this six-week class. How will you start the class? How will it progress? Because you're meeting for 6 weeks in a row on Wednesdays.
Sure. Well, I use a book that's put out by the Center for Civic Education. It's a book that they've been using for a long period of time. It's just kind of call it the We the People book, The Citizen and the Constitution. And it's laid out into six units of study. And the first unit deals with the philosophy behind the Constitution, with a focus on antiquity, ancient Greece and ancient Rome and classical republicanism, up to the Enlightenment with the natural rights thinkers. And so we'll take a look at that. That's the first week. The second week is the Constitution itself, the debate over ratification. Why did we write a Constitution? What was the struggle to get it ratified? The third unit deals with the it's kind of like it's sometimes called the Civil War unit. It focuses on perhaps the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, due process, equal protection of the laws. And then we move forward into Unit 4, which are the institutions, primarily looking at Supreme Court, the presidency or the executive branch, as well as the legislative branch. Unit 5 is the Bill of Rights, and we take a look at the Bill of Rights and the importance of those rights and how they've been extended over time. And Unit 6 is maybe a little more nebulous, but it's more about the challenges that we face moving forward as a nation. Mm-hmm. Now that we have these knowledge, what do we do with it? What are our responsibilities?
Okay, yeah, I like that last part because the philosophy that you started out with and then that last part, what are our challenges, everything in between sounds a little bit sort of procedural. The first and the last part, though, that sounds like there's potential for discussion on things like ethics and morality versus just procedure and semantics. Is that a fair assessment?
Oh, very much so. I think Unit 1 and Unit 6, we always talk about they're very, very similar in those ways that with that philosophy. The question of morality comes up, a rightness and wrongness of things. And certainly you see that as well as looking when we look at the challenges moving forward, because how should we progress, right? How should we move forward? And also the idea, we talk about rights quite often, especially in America, we talk about our rights. We like to think that's what separates us maybe sometimes from other people. Mm-hmm. But the other side of that equation are responsibilities. We have rights and responsibilities to citizenship. So what are those responsibilities? And that's, you know, that's for you and me and everybody else to try and figure out, I suppose.
We had a recent episode of The Why Show with a lawyer, and he talked about there is this very common belief that if someone sees an undercover cop and they suspect they're an undercover cop and say, hey, are you a cop? The cop has to say, yes, I am a cop. And that's just patently false. And I'm wondering, what are some of the common things that we think of as just true, non-negotiable parts of the Constitution that just are not true, or at the very least, not as clear as, are you a cop? Yes.
I'll bring this up because this is a topic I just discussed yesterday evening with some friends of mine, but the belief that we are a Christian nation, I hear that a lot, and you hear that from folks, and I say, well, point to that in the Constitution. Where in the Constitution do we see that? And you won't be able to really point to anything in the Constitution that says that. As a matter of fact, you'll see in Article 6 that it says there's no religious test for holding office. Now, certainly at the state level, at the time of the Constitution's ratification in 1787 and 1788, you know, many states had official religions, but within our national document, you will not see that. And, of course, when we get into the First Amendment and that debate about the separation of church and state, that is that's a highly debatable topic these days, and it's always been that way for various reasons. But I think that's one of the big things that people will talk about. And I'd like to say that we are a nation founded by a lot of folks that were Christian, but the idea that we are a Christian nation with our laws based on Christianity is, at least through our Constitution, is probably not quite accurate.
What about that that big stickler that comes up a lot, the right to bear arms? My understanding as a non-civics teacher, that it's really more you have the right to form a militia, the same way that back in the day when there weren't police departments, that maybe you'd be a volunteer fire department now and you would have had the right to bear arms to form a militia. Is that a little bit more accurate interpretation?
Well, I think, if there's one place they really needed an editor in the Bill of Rights, it was probably the Second Amendment, because when they say a well-regulated militia be necessary for the security of a free state, people's right to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. So what does that mean? And is there a qualifier? Does that mean that you have to have a firearm for a well-regulated militia? I think if you go back to the founding period, you will see that gun ownership was widespread, and many people would think that that was probably a privilege or immunity of citizenship that you were able to own a firearm. So I think it's pretty well established if you go back and look at other writings that people as individuals had a right to own a firearm. But they also have to understand that it does say a well-regulated militia. The idea is that, and the courts have backed this up, even in extending gun ownership rights, that the government does have the ability to regulate those firearms. Because if I may be a bad shot, maybe I need a chain gun or a rocket launcher. Mm. And I don't think anybody needs a chain gun or a rocket launcher because we draw the line on our rights, including the right to gun ownership.
A lot of people call the United States a democracy. Is it more accurate to call it a constitutional federal republic or some other term? And if so, why?
I try and tell my students that I like to think of it as a federal democratic republic. So I'm trying to cover all my bases. Federalism certainly is the idea that we divide power between the national government and state governments. State governments are the governments we bump into more often than not, right? Driver's license, you get a ticket, you pay your local taxes, roads and schools. Certainly federalism. So, we live in the sovereign state of North Dakota. Sovereign state means we make laws that are unique to our state. So there is that level of federalism. And we have argued about that from our nation's inception to this very conversation we're having right now. So is a democratic republic in the terms that people have the voice, people have the power. The first three words of the Constitution, we the people, helps establish that. And certainly the writings of James Madison himself would indicate that there's indication that people will be voting for their representatives, therefore the Republican side of things. We are too large and too diverse to run as a pure democracy, so we elect representatives to go to the school board, to go to the state house, to go to Congress, to go to the White House, and represent our viewpoints.
Is there a pure democracy in action today, somewhere?
Oh, my gosh. Pure democracy? Maybe only on small local levels, right? Because if you're talking about pure democracy, the word demo is a democracy is a Greek word. Demo means the people, and literally translated, as I understand it, means kind of like the poor people. As a matter of fact, Aristotle said that was a corrupt form of government. So I don't know, honestly. I don't know.
Put a little bit finer point on that word democracy, though. I mean, you started to get into it, but what would a pure democracy actually run like?
Well, I think if you think about the traditional New England town hall meeting, which they were famous for in the early days of the country, small town people coming together to vote on issues. And it's a slow, ponderous process. It can be messy. So that's a tough thing. You think of in California, they have ballot initiatives all the time. And so they take issues to the people of California all the time, perhaps because the state legislature doesn't want to wade into certain things. And so they put ballot initiatives on the ballot, take a right to the people to let them vote. But then again, in the pure democracy, that would mean everybody gets a voice. And in most places, there are folks that tend to be excluded, unfortunately.
We're visiting with Chris Kavanaugh. He will be leading the 6-week course, Adult Civic Education, Constitution 101. This is a free online class available at humanitiesnd.org. 6 Wednesdays in a row starting on February 24th at 6:30 p.m. It is a 2-hour class, again, for 6 weeks. Chris, what is on a basic U.S. citizenship test, and do you think that most people, most adults, could pass it?
Well, they just revamped it under President Trump's administration, which made it a little bit more difficult than what it used to be. Traditionally, there were 100 questions. You would get all 100 questions as well as the answers, and then when you would take the citizenship test, you would have to take a number of those and get a 60% basically to pass. The questions today are a little bit tougher, like what the Constitution is. That's maybe a little bit tougher question as opposed to, how many stars on the flag, that type of question. Do I think most Americans could pass it today, most adults? Probably not. No. Mm. I would actually like to see all of our elected officials before they take office actually see if they could pass it. I think that would be a good barometer for us as to whether or not this is important to be putting into schools.
What about for people who go to the polls on election day? Should they have to be able to pass a test like that, in your opinion?
No, because, when you start thinking about requiring tests for voting, you're hearkening back to a different era where there were literacy tests, and those literacy tests were put in place to exclude people from the ballot. And I don't think in our country we want to be excluding people. But what we do need to do is do a better job of educating the public as to the issues and ideas out there, and do it in a way that is a non-threatening, non-partisan way.
So what is your approach? Now, you are primarily teaching in your profession, in your day life, as a high school teacher, but your approach to that thoughtful education?
Well, I like to always try to think about what does the Constitution say? Now, obviously, it doesn't say anything. It doesn't speak. But wherein do we find this in the Constitution? I always try and tell my students, whenever the government takes an action, where do they get the power? Right. Where did we find that? Is there a precedent established? So that's what we try to do. Take it back to the documents, take it back to that, and then move forward from there. So, if you ground it in the documents, if you ground it in the document that the Constitution or the Declaration of Independence are perhaps court rulings or laws passed by Congress or actions taken by the president through executive orders, you know, always find out where does the government get the power. Mm. So I think that's a good way to approach it and start from there.
Build a castle in the sky here in terms of what would be the ideal reasoning behind every reasonable expectation of someone having a solid understanding of the U.S. Constitution. Is it purely to have an informed electorate, or does it go beyond that in some other way?
Well, I'm going to steal a term from a guy I learned a lot from, Dr. David Adler, and he talks about the term called Madisonian monitors, that we all have to be Madisonian monitors, and referring to James Madison, the architect of the Constitution and one of the most important founding fathers we have. And that what he means by that is we have to be aware enough. Do we need to know the Constitution by heart? No. Would it help? Probably. But we have to be aware enough of the powers found within the Constitution to be able to say, Mr. President, I don't think you can do that. Or, hey, Congress, you're supposed to do this. Why aren't you doing this? Or the courts doing this? What recourse do we have after the courts have a ruling? So we become the check on the government. We ultimately are the sovereign people. We are the sovereign people. And it's, you know, behooves us to make sure we understand how it works. It's a rule book in a way. And if you're going to play the game, you got to know the rules.
Some years ago, PBS had a series on Native Americans and on their contributions to society at large as we know it that have been very much written out of history. We talk about Greece and Rome all the time when we talk about founding principles of this country, and they took the point of view that much of what we view as our founding documents was actually based on a Haudenosaunee clan woman who was able to unite warring tribes, who later became the Iroquois Confederacy, and that her tactics were actually really what was used just as much or maybe even more than a Greek or Roman approach to that. Do you see that at all as we become a little bit more understanding and adapting our teaching methods to be more inclusive of reality?
I would say no, because the idea of the Iroquois Confederacy and its influence on the founding period has actually been overblown. I hate to say that. It's really not really representative. It goes back to a statement that Ben Franklin had made at one point. And, was it the inspiration for the Articles of Confederation, the government that we had, or that was our national government that was proposed in 1776 and ratified in 1781, that somehow the Iroquois Confederacy was the inspiration for the Articles of Confederation? And I don't believe that's historically accurate.
Interesting. Do you have discussions like this in your classroom with your students?
Try to have the understanding of what is a confederacy, what is a confederation. We have a discussion about sovereignty and power and who is sovereign. And, if you think about our history, it really has been a struggle for sovereignty. It's been a struggle for power from the very beginning of our nation's history. And certainly power taken away from the first peoples. I'm not trying to downplay the Native American contributions to our society. Unfortunately, you're very right. We have written many people out, and unfortunately, we're getting to the point now where we're actually trying to include more people in the story, which is very, very important. But we have discussions like this all the time.
What happened to those discussions right when the pandemic started and we had to be closing down schools. And I know this is going back a little ways now, mm-hmm. but just the approach that you had to take, pivoting very quickly from all in-person to all online to hybrid, how do you maintain that sense of continuity as a teacher?
Well, it's very difficult. I mean, all the teachers, I think, struggle because, you know, being in the room with your students, you see their body language, you see their facial expressions, you understand kind of whether they're uncomfortable. You can see the eye roll, you can see the exasperated sighs. You know, so when you move to online, you don't quite get those nuances, and certainly it becomes a struggle for some kids. You know, some of our kids, and just finding a quiet place to be able to log into class to participate real time. Mm. It was a struggle. So, you know, it kind of exposes the inequities in our society. And going back hybrid was very difficult, I think, for teachers and for students. And now, obviously, in North Dakota, we're back face-to-face. I think if you asked about any teacher, they would tell you they prefer face-to-face. And I think the kids maybe not agree with that, but I think some of the kids like the hybrid model because they felt like they may have a day off in there. But I think they're better served, obviously, in the face-to-face method. We just have to be careful that we're continuing to use the common sense things in terms of washing our hands and wearing our masks and socially distancing when we can.
Yeah, humans are pretty social. But I did have a friend who is a teacher who said that she was surprised to all of the sudden hear from some of her students much more when it was all virtual than she ever heard them talk in class. Just some of that fear of public speaking that is so profound, even,
yes.
you know, among your peers. Did you have, maybe not that silver lining, did you have silver linings that were maybe something that we should consider taking forward into the new normal?
I think that's true. You know, you have those kids that will sit in class and they're very quiet and maybe painfully shy and reluctant to participate. And so when we move to the online, that they may offer up more electronically than they would in that classroom setting. But, and certainly, you know, you mentioned the new normal and moving forward. It's hard to say what that new normal will be. But I think it's also important for us to understand that, you know, we have to teach our kids to become a little bit more comfortable in that interaction, right? In that connection, mm-hmm. in that personal connection. Because when they get out into the world, whether they go on to college or the workforce, whatever they do, they're going to have connection with people. And if we can teach them how to have that, they're going to be better served when they move into society.
Chris, your bachelor's is in journalism with a minor in history. How did you end up teaching history?
Good question. That was a roundabout way for sure. I was somewhat late to the profession, but I went back and got my teaching endorsement and picked up my education classes and a couple more history classes I needed to have. And then I was fortunate enough to complete my master's in history at Butler University in Indianapolis.
And the journalism then just helps you be a good speaker?
It helps me teach kids how to write short paragraphs.
Yes. What is that gray code? If I had more time, I would have written you a shorter letter. Editing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Chris, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Sure. My pleasure.
That was history teacher Chris Kavanaugh on his upcoming online class, Constitution 101, which starts Wednesday, February 24th, and runs for 6 weeks. It's free, and you can register at humanitiesnd.org. Natural North Dakota is next.
We've got plenty of home-cooked podcasts for you to subscribe to. You want to bone up on Aristotle? Then subscribe to Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life, hosted by UND philosophy professor Jack Russell Weinstein.
What's wrong with that argument?
Get to know the quiet, poetic grace of people, past and present, who make up our party region through Tom Esern's Plainsfolk essays.
Most of all, I'm thinking about that toothy fish.
And then there's the fascinating and diverse roster of guests on our daily statewide Conversation Convergence
Main Street. The belly laughs and fun culinary insights of Sue Balcom on Main Street Eats.
We're getting chickens, but don't tell them that, okay?
Breaking Barriers, a Red River Rainbow Seniors LGBTQ podcast. And then there's the always popular and shareable Dakota Date Book. You can subscribe to any one or all of these Prairie Public podcasts through Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, NPR One, or wherever you like to get them.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. Natural North Dakota is a series of essays about the animal and plant life that shares our part of the world. Chuck Lura is the naturalist and writer and voice of the series, and today his subject is about an animal that is symbolic in our region.
If I had one wish, it would probably be time travel. And one of the first places I would go would be the Great Plains of North America before European influence, to see for myself those immense herds of bison on their native range. There may have been up to 30 million or more bison in the plains of North America. What a sight that must have been. I was thinking about all that recently when I read an article about an expedition led by Isaac Stearns, who in the summer of 1853 left St. Paul for Puget Sound to explore and survey a route for a Pacific Railroad. On July 10th, the expedition camped near Lake Jesse, which is located near Binsford in Griggs County. Stephen seemed to be rather awestruck by the immense herds of bison he observed that day in North Dakota, as he wrote in his journal, and I quote, "Crossed the Cheyenne, ascended to the top of a high hill, and for a great distance ahead every square mile seemed to have a herd of buffalo upon it. Their number was variously estimated by members of the party, some as high as 500,000. I do not think it's any exaggeration to set it down at 200,000. I had heard of the myriads of these animals inhabiting these plains, but I could not realize the truth of these accounts till today, when they surpassed anything I could have imagined from the accounts I had received." By the way, Isaac's expedition camped near Lake Jesse at the same site used by the Nicollet-Fremont expedition of 1839. The campsite is commemorated by the Lake Jesse State Historic Site 2 miles west of Jesse. If you visit this historic site, you may have the same view that so amazed Stevens. And it was a pleasant surprise and coincidence that the 1990 movie Dances with Wolves, starring Kevin Costner, recently ran on one of our cable stations. That's a great movie, and I had forgotten how impressive some of those scenes of a bison hunt were in the movie. Time travel's not going to happen, so historical records and seeing those scenes with large herds of bison in the movie can give us a sense of just how immense those herds may have been at times. And, of course, they could have been even more than we could have imagined. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. Subscribe to the podcast or find past episodes at prairiepublic.org.
Hey, kids, do you have a story to tell? Enter it in the 2021 PBS Kids Writers Contest. We're looking for amazing, original stories from writers in kindergarten through the third grade. So tap into your imagination, break out the crayons and magic markers, and start writing today. When you enter, you'll have the chance to win and see your story published online. First place winners in each grade level will receive prizes and have their stories featured on the Prairie Public website. Everyone who enters will get a certificate of achievements. Find the rules and entry forms along with a writer's guide to help you brainstorm and develop plots at prairiepublic.org. The deadline to submit your original story is Friday, April 2nd. The 2021 PBS Kids Writers Contest. Enter today.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 15th. On this date in 1907, the Washburn leader noted that North Dakota was fortunate to have strong representation in Washington. The senior senator was H.C. Hansbrough. He was born in Illinois in 1848. When he moved to Dakota Territory, he started two newspapers, the Grand Forks News and the Devil's Lake Interocean. In 1889, Hansbrough was elected to represent the new state of North Dakota in the House of Representatives.
In 1891, he was elected to the Senate and served until 1909. Although he was a Republican, he supported Democrat Woodrow Wilson and approved of Franklin Roosevelt's farm programs during the Depression. Hansbrough died in 1933. Senator Porter J. McCumber was the junior senator. He was born in Illinois in 1858. He earned a law degree from the University of Michigan and started a practice in Wahpeton. McCumber was elected to Congress in 1899. He was a staunch promoter of North Dakota interests, and he was an advocate for pure food and drug laws, supporting the standards promoted by Dr. Edwin Ladd, a professor at the North Dakota Agricultural College. McCumber served on many committees, including Finance and Indian Affairs. His major accomplishment was the passage of the 40-McCumber Tariff Act of 1922. The act originally helped North Dakota's farmers. In return, European countries enacted their own tariffs. This hurt farmers as the cost of farm goods like plows, harnesses, and farm wagons began to rise. In 1922, McCumber lost a primary to former Governor Lynn Frazier. He opened a law practice in Washington and was a staunch supporter of President Wilson's League of Nations. He died in 1933. Also part of North Dakota's 1907 delegation were two representatives. Thomas Marshall was born in Missouri and moved to Dakota Territory as a young man. He worked as a surveyor and a banker. He served in the House of Representatives from 1901 to 1909. The other representative was Osley Grana. He served in the House from 1905 to 1911, when he was elected to the Senate. He gained nationwide notoriety as an isolationist. He staunchly opposed America's entrance into World War I, as well as participation in the League of Nations. North Dakota history often focuses on what happened within the borders of the state. It is important to remember that the state has also played an important role on the national stage. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Meryl Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. As we broadcast, we stream at prairiepublic.org, and after the broadcast, you can find any Main Street show archived as a podcast at prairiepublic.org. Tuesday on our show, for a lot of people, North Dakota's last oil boom became a beckoning call of the wild. Mostly men from around the country, even the world, flocked to the Bakken to make fast money from the mineral-rich earth. Singer, songwriter, playwright, and author Michael Patrick F. Smith has a debut book from Penguin Random House. It's titled The Good Hand, a memoir of work, brotherhood, and transformation in an American boomtown. Prairie Public's Eric Dethridge, who knows the author from their days in Maryland, hosts this conversation. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.